a kilo of methamphetamine in China or Mexico is probably about $1,000 to buy. That same kilo here in New Zealand retails for around $180,000. It's not a physically addictive drug like heroin, but psychologically very addictive. It makes you feel incredible, makes you feel 10 foot tall. In every level of the supply chain, it's worth money.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. With spectacular glaciers, hot springs, beautiful sandy beaches, and an envious response to COVID-19, New Zealand is the envy of the world. With a population just shy of 5 million, it's made up of a North and South Islands, which have attracted movie makers in their droves, turning it into the Hollywood of the Pacific. But there's also a shadowy side to New Zealand, and journalist Jared Savage knows all about it. He's the country's top crime correspondent, and he's just penned a book on gangland, which tells the grim tale of the rise of a dangerous underworld fueled by an insatiable appetite for meth. He tells me about biker gangs, cold-blooded murder, and the real-life Walter White. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Kind of always have this idyllic view of New Zealand about, you know, the Lord of the Rings and your beautiful country and your beautiful climate, and everything seems so perfect, including your response to the pandemic. We're all so jealous of you all over the rest of the world, you know. Jacinta Ardern seems to be the only one that's doing it properly. And then we look at your work and what you're doing, which is similar to me, except you're just in a totally different country, and you have the same problems as we do. I have to say, I've read your book, and you are about 10 or 15 years behind us with a different drug.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, a lot of your listeners and, you know, people living overseas would see New Zealand as an idyllic sort of place, and certainly at the moment with COVID, you know, we're looking pretty good, but you know, underlying all of it, we have the same social issues that are seen around the world. You know, the gap between the haves and the have-nots has increased recently. We have housing problems, we have poverty, we have drug and alcohol abuse, we have horrific rates of domestic violence, and it's, you know, it's all tied into the same sorts of issues. So, yeah, certainly drug issues, methamphetamine in particular, has really changed the criminal underworld here in the last sort of 20 years or so. Yeah, and I'd agree. We often think we're about 5 years behind Australia, and so I'd say, yeah, 10 to 15 years behind the UK and Ireland would be bang on.
So the issue with drugs kind of started to come to light for you guys in New Zealand really in the 90s. It wasn't so much a problem in the 80s and the 70s, when I suppose here we would have started with, you know, our heroin problem, which really ignited everything. But tell me about New Zealand in the 80s and then what happens in the 90s.
Sure thing. So, I mean, yeah, absolutely. New Zealand hasn't really, in the 70s and 80s, New Zealand didn't really have a hard drug problem. A lot of cannabis here. Obviously, we've got a good climate and a lot of space to grow cannabis. So that was probably the stock and trade and the drug of choice for drug users. And, you know, people will have views either way on how harmful cannabis is. We had some heroin, small amounts of heroin in the 1980s. People were sort of baking it themselves, some imported. But really, things really changed a lot in the late 90s with methamphetamine being introduced here. In particular, it was quite a potent form of methamphetamine. It was a pure form of methamphetamine, not what we would recall as speed, which is sort of like a half-cut amphetamine drug. So quite quickly, it became a very popular drug here in New Zealand. It's not a physically addictive drug like heroin, but psychologically very addictive. It makes you feel incredible, makes you feel 10 foot tall, sexy, intelligent, makes you feel articulate, huge amounts of energy, and it really took off in that late 90s. Of course, that's, you know, the cycle of addictions, a terrible thing to overcome. So people, it was popular amongst from anywhere, from the white collar, you know, and people living in the leafy suburbs, you know, kids going to private schools, your office workers down in downtown Auckland, which is our largest city. And then, you know, all the way through across society, really. And the motorcycle gangs in particular, the outlaw motorcycle gangs here, the Hells Angels, the Highway 61 and the Headhunters, just to name a few, they soon cottoned on to the huge amounts of money to be made from it. Incredibly lucrative profits here, literally millions of dollars floating around. So all of a sudden they went from, you know, controlling supply of cannabis and, you know, the sex trade to a lesser extent, to then being in control of this methamphetamine trade. And it just took off. And in those early days it was very popular, like I said, across all sections of society, but it soon got a stigma in regards to, you know, it made people do some pretty crazy, horrific crimes. We had some we had some really terrible, we called it P as well, P for pure. We had some quite P-fueled crimes, horrific murders of children even. And so it got a bit of a stigma and it sort of probably pushed it underground a wee bit, but it's certainly always been there, and then it sort of maybe it didn't die from view, it was always there, but possibly because it was afflicting poorer rural communities, it probably didn't get quite the same sort of media coverage. And then about 5 years ago, we'd sort of seen another big, a second wave of the epidemic, I suppose, in a way, and it's really come back quite strong.
So, Jared, meth we're not familiar with, you know, here. We would certainly see a lot of it from the States and, you know, there's the whole meth teeth and all that. What exactly is it and how is it made?
It's a stimulant. It's a synthetic compound. So it's not naturally, it's not from a natural plant or anything like cocaine. It's a stimulant which was first developed way back in the early 1900s by chemists. It was, in some way, shape or form, it was used as a stimulant legally for quite some time. It was used by soldiers in World War II. Here and then, of course, being synthetic, the chemical extraction process has refined over the years and become more potent. And then it started getting outlawed in the US in the 70s, and then around the world from then. It can come in different like forms. Like you can, it's like the most common form we would see here would be in like a crystalline form or a powder form. You can most commonly smoke here in like a small glass mm-hmm. pipe, or people even use light bulbs to heat the bulb and then inhale it. It can also be snorted, it can be swallowed, it can be injected. So just to give your listeners an idea of the profits, because you might just think, oh, New Zealand, little country at the end of the world, why would transnational organised groups target New Zealand? Our prices here are incredible for it. A kilo of methamphetamine in China or Mexico is probably about $1,000 to buy. If you move that kilo from Mexico to the United States, it's probably worth $5,000. That same kilo here in New Zealand at a wholesale level, so a user wouldn't buy a kilo of it, right? We smoke it in a tenth of a gram, but a kilo of it currently retails for around $180,000. So you go from one to five to $180,000. It got as low as $120,000 because $120,000 because basically the introduction, the arrival of these Mexican cartels joining sort of the Asian groups that were pushing it, and it flooded the market. But to put it into context, before, prior to that, we're probably talking $300,000 for a kilo, which is worth, in every level of the supply chain, it's worth money. So if you're wholesaling it for a kilo, you then break it into ounces. So an ounce is about 28.5 grams. That can be worth anywhere between $12,000 to $18,000, depending on supply. You break it down further, into grams, that's fluctuated anywhere between $400 to $800 a gram. But what has remained constant the entire time, no matter what's happened, is that a point of a gram, so a tenth of a gram, is always retailed for around $100, and that's been maintained for 20 years. So there's a huge amount of money to be made, millions of dollars.
And the reason it's so expensive, is that because you're an island? I mean, I'm saying that, and we are too. But it's because it's difficult to transport it in. I mean, are the dealers and those not making meth in that it's synthetic? Are they not making it in the country and in that way reducing the cost?
I've often wondered why it's stayed so high at that level. It's simply the demand for it, I think. We don't really have a cocaine or... So, like, MDMA would be popular in, like, sort of like the nightclub sort of dance scene in Auckland and maybe some of the other bigger centres. Until recently, we haven't had a lot of cocaine being imported. Obviously, that can only really come from South America or Mexico. It's, for whatever reason, it's just the drug that's really hooked into New Zealanders. I mean, I'm not saying everyone's walking around. You know, I think the figures are around 1% of the population. But heavily entrenched, so using it a lot. A lot of people can mask their addiction and keep working. I can't really put a figure on as to why it stayed so high, but I put it down to demand, and I also put it down to organised criminal groups controlling the supply of it. So I would not be surprised if it, you know, your stock...
They control they're controlling the price as well, obviously, and they're keeping that price up, yeah. You talk about cocaine and perhaps it's on the way, perhaps it's not going to be a drug of choice for Kiwis, but I was writing recently, we can't talk about it too much because some of it is before the courts here, but there was... certainly entrepreneurs from here who were actually flying over as far as New Zealand and Australia with cocaine mules, human mules flying because the price of cocaine with you is so high. You are four times higher than our street price of coke. So therefore, if you can take 25,000 quid's worth of it in your stomach, people were taking the chance to make the flight because they'll turn that into 100,000.
Yeah, so, and again, that just shows, you know, how even though we're a small market, we're an attractive market because of those profits to be made. Yeah, cocaine, and I'm familiar with the case that you refer to there, and when that sort of cropped up maybe 3 or 4 years ago here, that was sort of the beginning of the time where we were seeing more cocaine coming into the market. It's always been there or thereabouts, more so in Auckland, which is our main city and also our main port and our main airport. So most of the population's there, you know, and like many places around the world, popular with probably white-collar professionals more often, but simply because of the price. I think it fluctuates, but the price of a gram here of cocaine is about $350. And obviously the high from cocaine is not as long-lasting as meth. Maybe that's partly down to its popularity of meth to it. The high from it lasts quite some time. We're talking probably 12 hours.
8 hours.
Yeah, 8 to 12 hours. So we're definitely seeing more cocaine, and we're often seeing more cocaine coming through with some methamphetamine shipments from the South Americas and Mexico. We have a new sort of one of the recent arrivals in New Zealand, some of these Australian gangs. Australia brought in they changed the migration laws a few years ago to be able to deport anyone on good character grounds. So what they, which many countries do, but what they used it for was to get rid of the many of their senior criminals basically, and deport them back to New Zealand or the Pacific Islands where they might have been born. So so really, these people had lived their entire lives in Australia, growing up there, all their social networks and friends and whatever were Australian. They speak with an Australian accent, and they were deported here. Literally, they might have been born here and then moved to Australia, which is a common thing in New Zealand and migration around the world. So all of a sudden, we had these very, thousands of people getting deported back here for various reasons, and a small proportion of them were quite senior members of Australian motorcycle gangs who were, as I said before, were probably about 5 years behind Australia in terms of our organised criminal structures, but that's really accelerated things. So they came here with quite a brash attitude, I would say, ruffling some feathers, not really keen to necessarily just fit in with the establishment, established criminal world here. They brought quite a tough attitude with them, quite genuine transnational links across the world, because many of these groups have chapters around the world, so as well as quite superior, like quite a step up in terms of criminal counter surveillance. So in terms of they were aware of, and not that the criminals here weren't aware of how the police investigated them, but it was like a step up in terms of encrypted devices, counter surveillance techniques, in terms of just meeting in parks and never talking inside cars or houses and things like that. So I've digressed here, but basically they also have cocaine's more popular in Australia than it is here. So I guess they've tried to introduce that with methamphetamine as well.
The motorbike gangs are, again, something that just are not big here. There are small motorbike gangs that have been, you know, there's been a little bit of investigation into their activities, but certainly it would not be a thing here. I think across the world, the biker gangs have moved meth and have pushed meth. That is their drug that funds their other activities. But so where did they come from originally in New Zealand? And, you know, how do they pop up, or how do they get together? I'm sure in the same way most criminal gangs, it's probably a silly question, but for us that don't see them.
I'll confess that I'm not, there's probably a sociological aspect to this, which is I'm not an expert in, but basically many of the gangs here, we'd have two groups of gangs, I should say. So on one hand, you've got the outlaw motorcycle groups, which in New Zealand, New Zealand was the first country in the world outside of the United States to have a chapter of the Hells Angels. So Hells Angels would probably be the most infamous motorcycle gang globally. I think Auckland was the first place to get a chapter. I think it was in the 1960s. They recently celebrated 50 or 60 years anyway. But, you know, they were in those early days, I think they were probably just misfits, social outcasts. Many of them were returning soldiers coming back from various wars, didn't feel like they fitted in anymore, banded together to, to as a form of brotherhood, perhaps. So that's dating back several decades now, and we have our own. So as well as the Hells Angels, there was a group we would call the Highway 61. The Headhunters are a New Zealand-grown group. And for a long time, and there's all sorts, Devil's Henchmen, the Road Knights, there's a whole bunch of them, but quite small groups probably in the early days. A chapter would be, 20 to 30 people. Involved in various skirmishes and pub fights and kind of like quite low level thuggish sort of stuff, I suppose. There would have been some, involvement in the cannabis trade and the sex trade and things like that. And the other group that we have here, we would call them, well, the police call them ethnic gangs, which sounds probably a little bit not really that PC anymore. But so in New Zealand, we have the mongrel mob, which is our biggest gang by far, several thousand members, divided into chapters, you know, geographical chapters, each with their own president. And the Black Power is another group here. So largely Māori and Pacific Island membership. Again, probably drawn together by trauma in their childhoods, I would say. Physical and sexual abuse, poverty, drug abuse, alcohol in the family, that sort of thing. So again, I without wanting to generalise it too much, you know, drawn together by being social outcasts, I think, and being together in yeah. a brotherhood. That's the historical sort of, you know, context yes. to it. And then I think with the advent of methamphetamine, some of those groups got control of it quite early. So the Headhunters in particular, Hell's Angels, Highway 61, they controlled the supply of it and the manufacture of it. And some of the other groups were probably more affected by the use of it, actually, and the damage that it's done to their families. So, but methamphetamine has definitely changed the gangs from being middling players, I suppose, in that criminal world, to some of them being quite powerful.
And one of the first stories in your book, Gangland, New Zealand's Underworld of Organised Crime, is one about William Wallace, who worked in an airline company. And, you know, you found this story, I think, through the courts, that you were covering the courts. This guy had started to fix bikes in his redundancy. He set up a place where he was fixing the bikes, and he met up with these guys from the Highway 61 motorcycle gang. And all of a sudden, I think the police there realised, it was in the late 90s, that he was actually running a meth factory. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a real, you know, it's a real Breaking Bad sort of Walter White type story in a way. He was a guy yeah. who'd been straight all his life. Got made redundant, had a midlife crisis, so he started running, an electroplating business, you know, putting chrome on bikes and cars and all sorts of things. And, yeah, he met these Highway 61 guys, and one thing led to another, and they realised, you know, or he realised that he had these skills, because it's quite a complicated process to, you know, to cook meth, manufacture it. And he became probably one of the first big-time meth cooks here, and just made truckloads of money. So, like, he was, you know, he built, you know, got a nice house, built a big stone wall around it for $100,000, flash cars, trips overseas, and the works, really. And that particular story is sort of seen as the tipping point, really, where I think the police here realised the scale of what was happening. This is still the very early days, you know, late 90s. And, he was working with the Highway 61, which, interestingly, isn't really around anymore. I talk about how some of these groups were transformed and made more influential and powerful, and the Headhunters would be the main one there. But Highway 61, basically methamphetamine led to a whole bunch of infighting within their group. One of their members killed their president, you know, so all of a sudden the police are investigating that, and so they kind of imploded, really, and they're not really... they're still around, but they've certainly fallen away compared to some of these other groups. And now we have these Australians turning up and muscling in and creating some friction here, which has changed things again.
And Jared, what happened to William Wallace and the real life Walter White? Is he still with us?
I couldn't actually find the answer to that question. I think he was fairly old at the time that he went away. I think he was in his early 60s at that time. We're talking 20 years ago now, but yeah, I struggled to find him, actually. So he maybe he read about himself in his Christmas present. I don't know, but
it's an incredibly interesting story, and just the parallels are quite extraordinary for anyone who's watched Breaking Bad, except I think I think he chose to go into the game for the money, didn't he? Which can often be a rarity in that world. The headhunters you've spoken about, were they the first gangs to team up with the big Asian mafias, or were they the ones who really brought it to a new level for you?
Yeah, that's right. I think so just to give a bit of context as to why that's important. So methamphetamine, the main ingredient is pseudoephedrine, which is a chemical most commonly found in cold and flu medicine. So what was happening was the gangs were sending people into pharmacies and buying truckloads of, you know, pseudo-fed cold and flu medicine over the counter. They would come back, open the packets up, tip out all the granules from the medicines and extract the pseudoephedrine from that, which is then cooked into, you know, with other chemicals and heat and into methamphetamine. So what happened eventually was is that pseudoephedrine-based medicines were banned in New Zealand, which is actually a terrible shame because they're the most effective cold and flu medicine. So we have really rubbish. Don't get a cold in New Zealand. We have really rubbish cold and flu medicine now. But the ban didn't work because in China, they have lots of pseudoephedrine-based medicines, one called Contact NT. So any of the Asian groups basically just got their buddies back home in China to go buy truckloads of them, of pseudoephedrine medicines, shell them and send them over here. So if you had good links back to China, you could source pseudoephedrine for your manufacture here in New Zealand. And that's really what the headhunters, they had quite good contacts with Asian groups themselves. They also had quite good contacts with, you know, methamphetamine cooks who had good Asian, strong Asian contacts. So they had that supply of pseudoephedrine coming in, despite the fact that it was banned here and hard, more difficult to get. So that was, yeah, that's what really sort of led to them becoming quite strong in it. Well, members of their gang becoming quite strong and influential in that world, making literally millions of dollars and funding a lifestyle far beyond what they would have been legitimately earning.
Now, like the rest of the world, you're probably seeing the seizures that are made going up and up and up in size. And, you know, 20 years ago, what would have made the headlines probably isn't even, you know, ruffling any feathers nowadays.
Yeah.
But you know, you spoke about the Australians coming in. I think you've also probably seen the arrival of that narco culture that the Mexicans maybe, developed. But you have, you in your book, you talk about the Comancheros. Am I pronouncing that right? And they're another biker gang who posed for photographs with their gold-plated Harleys.
Yeah, gold-plated Harleys. Yeah, pretty... Pretty, I mean, it was quite, there's been a change in the culture as well between the old school and the new school gangsters coming through. So, you know, some of these younger guys, so the Comancheros were among these groups that were members of which deported from Australia, which I mentioned earlier. They come up here, they love showing off in Australia, there's quite a good term, they call it the Nike bikey, So these are guys that they're wearing Versace. So I go on to court, right, and these guys get sentenced and they're wearing Versace, black, like quite garish black and gold, which is their colours, putting it on Instagram. They've got flash bikes, flash cars, flash homes, good-looking girlfriends. You know, they're quite willing to show it off. And, you know, of course, you know, that would have some benefits in terms of recruitment, I think, as well. And marrying it up was quite a ruthless attitude at times. There was, an execution style double murder, well, murder and attempted murder of a husband and wife, simply for basically besmirching the Comancheros name. And that was seen by the police here as this new group stamping their mark, really, and just saying, we're not here to muck around and make friends. So, definitely it's, you know, it's the introduction of these Australian gangs, but also the younger generation of established gangs coming through are also prolific on social media, and similarly, they look great. Like they're gym junkies. You know, they got nice haircuts, cool tattoos, nice Rolexes and cars and things. So definitely, it's a generational shift too, and that's creating friction between some of these, between the older hierarchy and the young bulls coming through as well.
And we most definitely see that here as well. It's a culture, really, isn't it? And that's really why, you know, it's kind of getting closer and closer to that narco territory of Central and South America. I just maybe, you know, ask you something that isn't miserable and drug related and gangland.
That's good.
Yeah, I know. Just to finish on a lighter note, maybe, but. Just tell us something, because we're here in Ireland and we're in this awful, awful lockdown again. The weather is awful. It's winter time and we're getting really, really tired, and everybody's struggling a little bit with it. Tell us something lovely that we can think about you're in your summer now, so the sun must be shining. Have you been to a gig or anything?
No, I haven't been to a gig lately, but I live in Tauranga, which is about 2.5 hours southeast of Auckland. Beautiful white sandy beaches, blue surf water, the sun shining most days. We're living in what seems to be a parallel universe. I kind of look at what's happening around the world and see the rest of the world burning a little bit, and I just think, man, I'm very blessed and privileged to be living here. But we look forward to the day when the borders are back open and we can welcome all our Irish friends to come back and visit us. So please make sure you come and see me when this horrific pandemic ends.
I think, Jared, I am going to have some serious investigating to do in New Zealand into the underworld myself. It'll take me over there. It sounds absolutely fabulous. Listen, thank you so much for your time, and very interesting to hear what's happening on the other side of the world. Thank you, Jared Savage.
Pleasure. Thank you.
From SundayWorld.com, this is Crime World, produced by Ian Mullaney. Available online and on all podcast platforms. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review. And if you want to get in touch, check out our Facebook page, Crime World with Nicola Tallant.